The Gothic Symphony Examined.
The opening bars of the Gothic Symphony, the Symphony No. 1 of Havergal Brian. Welcome to this program in which we're exploring this extraordinary symphony. William Havergal Brian was born in 1876 and died in 1972, aged 96 years of age. He had one of the longest creative writing periods of any composer. During his long life, he wrote 32 symphonies, 22 of those after the age of 80. And 8 of them after the age of 90. This is an extraordinary achievement. We're going to look tonight at his first symphony, his Symphony No. 1, subtitled The Gothic. It was composed between the years 1919 and 1927, but it had to wait a very long time till its first performance. That occurred in 1961. It was mostly an amateur performance, but it did inspire a performance to be mounted under the conductorship of Sir Adrian Boult with the BBC's forces of choirs and orchestras, and in 1966 in the Royal Albert Hall. The performance took place to a packed hall, and this recording has only just been released over 40 years later on the Testament label by the BBC to great acclaim. What we just heard was the opening bars of the Gothic Symphony from that 1966 performance conducted by Adrian Boult. Now, during this program, this next 2 hours, we're going to be hearing from some of the people involved in the performance of the Gothic Symphony in Brisbane here on the 22nd of December in the Concert Hall at QPAC. This will be an historic performance. It will be 30 years since the last performance in public of Havergal Brian's Gothic Symphony. That was in 1980, again in the Albert Hall in London. The performance in Brisbane on the 22nd of December has completely sold out. But just this week, tickets have gone on sale for the open rehearsal, which will be at 10 a.m. on the 22nd of December, that's a Wednesday, the 22nd of December at 10 a.m. in the Concert Hall of QPAC. The orchestra will be under the conductorship of John Currow, and the orchestra consists of the alumni of the Queensland Youth Orchestra, and these are players who are now performing in orchestras all over Australia and indeed internationally. The choirs are made up of members of a wide range of choirs from throughout Brisbane, and indeed there will be some participation from some singers from Melbourne. So this is a truly significant performance, the first public performance of this symphony in 30 years, and only the fifth ever public performance. This is also the first performance in public of this work outside of England. So if you have purchased a ticket for the performance at 7 p.m. on the 22nd of December, you are indeed very fortunate. But if you do want to experience the amazing music of this symphony, you can purchase a ticket through QTix on 136246 for the open rehearsal in the morning. Now, we have in the orchestra approximately 170 players, and the first half a dozen rows of the concert hall seating have to be removed to accommodate the extended stage, and we have just under 300 singers in the choir. So it's quite an amazing piece. There are also some brass ensembles, a children's choir of about 40 singers and 4 soloists. So this is something not to be missed. It's a wonderful experience. So let's start this journey through this amazing symphony, composed, as I said, between 1919 and 1927. The first movement is marked Allegro assai, and let's start again with that opening, and we're going to use the performance recorded in 1966. It may sound a little scratchy, but it's a marvellous performance by Sir Adrian Bolt. We'll hear just a few minutes of that opening section, and then we'll play that same section conducted by André Lenard with the CSR Symphony Orchestra of Bratislava and the Slovak Philharmonic. And this was from a recording released on the Marco Polo label and just reissued on the Naxos label. So let's just hear now two conductors' interpretation of this dramatic opening to Havergal O'Brien's Symphony No. 1, The Gothic. And there we heard the first part of the first movement of Havergal O'Brien's Symphony No. 1, The Gothic. That was under the baton of Sir Adrian Bolt, recorded in 1966 in the Royal Albert Hall in London. The first commercial recording of The Gothic was released about 15 years ago on the Marco Polo label and now re-released on the Naxos label. Let's listen to how André Lenard, the conductor, takes this first section. We'll just hear really just the first couple of minutes. It's taken in a much faster pace. Adrian Bolt had a grand sweep for this opening. But let's hear now how André Lenard does this first section. The opening of Havergal O'Brien's Symphony No. 1, The Gothic, composed between 1919 and 1927. The life and works, but especially the works, of Havergal O'Brien constitute one of the strangest phenomena in the world of 20th century British music. A contemporary of Vaughan Williams and Gustav Holst, he was born in 1876 to working-class parents in the Staffordshire Potteries. The kind of background from which, in those days, major creative artists simply did not come. He left school at age 12 and started work for a coal mine, for timber firms, and as a carpenter's apprentice. But he had a good, if haphazard, musical education, and filled with an unquenchable desire to write music, he persisted against all odds throughout a very long and often hard life. He died in 1972 at the age of 96, but for roughly 80 of those years he had been composing. It's one of the longest creative careers ever. He had known sudden success in the early 1900s, then personal crisis, social rejection, hard times, disappointment, and for most of his last 50 years, almost total obscurity. He was never absolutely forgotten, and his music won acclaim from, amongst others, Elgar, Richard Strauss, Tovey, Eugene Goossens, Adrian Bolt, and more. But he was commonly regarded as one of the generation that had had their chance and failed to justify it before World War I. But since the 1950s, there has been a spasmodic but unmistakable growth of interest in Havergal O'Brien's music, accelerating in recent years with the appearance of many fine recordings of, amongst others, his 3rd, 7th, his 9th symphony, his 10th and 21st symphony. It's his first symphony, however, the Gothic, that remains his most famous, or should we say infamous, work. This is on account of its length and the gigantic forces employed, which have earned it an entry in the Guinness Book of Records under Largest Symphony. Nevertheless, it is in many ways his most personal and crucial work, the one that cost him most dearly in the writing, the massive keystone of his copious creative oeuvre. Before it came songs and choral works, short orchestral pieces, and the satirical anti-war opera The Tigers, from the early 20th century. After it, after the Gothic, came the long line of symphonies, numbers 2 to 32, but none of them on the same scale as the mammoth Gothic symphony, but all affected by the experience of writing this extraordinary symphony. Havergal Brian seems to have composed the Gothic symphony at various times through a period of about 8 years, and he was over 50 when he completed it. It unites two long contemplated schemes, a work on Goethe's Faust and a setting of the Te Deum, in a symphonic vision of the Gothic Age as a period of almost unlimited expansions of human knowledge, both secular and spiritual, both glorious and terrible. The structure of the symphony is that the first three movements for large orchestra form part one, which relates in a general way to Goethe's Faust. Part one, Faust as the archetypal Gothic age man, seeker after hidden knowledge and aspiring mystic. But in a sense, part one is only a prelude. It's made up of three movements, and then the fourth, fifth, and sixth movements constitute part two, and they're about twice the length of part one. And here, Havergal Brian's inspiration was the mighty Gothic cathedral and the music that was sung in those cathedrals. So let's return now to part one of Havergal Brian's Symphony No. 1, the Gothic, and we're going to hear just the final minutes of the first movement of the Gothic Symphony. And that was the end of the first movement of Havergal Brian's Symphony No. 1, the Gothic. As I mentioned before, we heard that excerpt. The Gothic Symphony can be seen as a tribute to the great Gothic Age. But it's more than that. It's also a tribute to all the music that Havergal Brian had known and loved, and all the people he cared about. He wrote to his friend Granville Bantock in 1926, "This work has been inside my heart for a lifetime, and naturally there is inside it all those who have been very dear to me, who helped and moulded me." On another occasion he spoke of the fifth movement, the Judex, as his personal memorial to Hans Richter, whose conducting of the Halle Orchestra had been such an inspiration to Brian in his youth. So the Gothic Symphony is an acknowledgement of debts to the past and a manifesto for the future. So here we are in the slow second movement. It's a grand processional in 5/4 time. It's regarded as Brian's first totally mature and personal symphonic statement. Two main elements, that dotted note rhythm on tubas and timpani at the outset of the piece we've just heard, and a noble, subtly flexible march melody, stated by the violas and cellos immediately afterwards. They're developed both in association and in competition. Now we come to a section which takes us through some strange territory. There's one rather blizzard-like episode which seems to anticipate Vaughan Williams' Sinfonia Antarctica by at least 30 years. And it rises to great climactic statements of the march theme. The last of these is a passage of a great splendour, very hard, almost granite-like splendour, with most of the orchestra hewing out the theme in even crotchets in E-flat major, while six horns bay out this theme. So it's a very original piece, with the final climax subsiding suddenly into the shadow, and after a softly reminiscent coda for the horns and the tubas, a bass clarinet leads directly into the third movement, which is a vivace scherzo finale for this first part of the Symphony No. 1 of Havergal Brian. The first part of the symphony is three orchestral movements. And then after the third movement, we come into the grand finale of the work, the part two, which is over an hour in duration, a fully choral movement. So let's return to this slow movement, the second movement of Havergal O'Brien's Symphony No. 1, the Gothic. And that was the end of the slow movement of the Gothic Symphony. The Gothic Symphony, the Symphony No. 1 of Havergal O'Brien, is dedicated to Richard Strauss, who wrote glowingly to Havergal O'Brien of his love of the music and of his admiration for the composer in composing such an extraordinary piece of music. And indeed, in 1925, Joseph Holbrooke produced a book on contemporary British composers, and it contained a chapter on Havergal O'Brien. And in this book, Holbrooke refers to O'Brien as one of the most strange and individual musicians of our time. In the book published in 1945, called Ordeal by Music, The Strange Experience of Havergal O'Brien by Reginald Nettle, the composer indicates how the composition of the Gothic came about and affected him. Havergal O'Brien wrote, "The composition of the Gothic Symphony presented no problems beyond the usual vexatious one of the finale. Should it be instrumental or choral? As the first part was orchestral, it was largely coloured by Goethe's Faust, Part 2. I had an idea of setting to a choral finale a large portion of the last act of Faust, Part 2, but the Te Deum has never been out of my mind as a work to be done. As it pushed itself forward as the only possible finale for the Gothic Symphony, I got to work at it quickly, and it was written as stated. A rainy night or a howling wind with rain driving on the panes is an inspiration. I always work with a green shaded table lamp, a trick I learnt in the First World War when there was threat of bombing by the Zeppelins. And in the days of working on the Gothic, the shade was extra thick, so that the rest of the room away from my table was in darkness. If, in those midnight hours, I sometimes saw Frederick the Great, or Johann Sebastian Bach, or Goethe, or Berlioz, sitting in an armchair in the darkness by the fire, I attached no importance to the phenomenon. Such happenings must drive others off their mental balance. I have always felt that I, being the only person interested in my work, would discover a solution to all the mysteries about it." It ranks as one of Brian's greatest symphonic inspirations. It's the scherzo finale of Part 1, the three orchestral, purely orchestral movements of the Gothic Symphony. It starts with a rather sinister opening paragraph over a rushing Brucknerian ostinato in D minor. The movement begins to develop through a series of contrasted episodes at different speeds, which slowly disclose a huge, relentless underlying momentum. The principal motif is turned into a mysterious, rather glowing horn call and becomes a base for stormy developments in the movement. Eventually, the accumulated tension gathers to a head in a violent, warlike development full of march and fanfare images. Then, in an astonishing passage, the movement acquires, instead of any recapitulation, a further fantastic development, rather weirdly scored with a quite bizarre xylophone cadenza that is eventually sucked into the polytonal ostinato. A figure of four descending trombone pedal notes, already heard at various points, now enters on all the low brass instruments to force tonal movement of the music crashes into a thundering climax that is the logical culmination of the early battlefield imagery. And then a crushingly decisive cadence hurls her back into D minor, and a coda of unexpected calm ensues. The mysterious horn call is heard for the last time, and the music mounts to a last shimmering triad of D major. So, as I said, one of Havock O'Brien's greatest symphonic inspiration, full of amazing developments, particularly, as you will hear, that rather bizarre and exciting xylophone cadenza. So let's come now to the Vivace Scherzo Finale for Part 1, the third movement of the Gothic Symphony. Incidentally, these three movements were entered as the British entry in an international composition competition in the late 1920s, early 1930s. And if the records are to be believed, and certainly it's mentioned in Reginald Nettle's book, Ordeal by Music, Havock O'Brien's entry, these first three orchestral movements of the Gothic Symphony, came very close to winning that competition. Indeed, the winning entry was by Kurt Atterberg, but it is understood that the judges, the panel of judges, spent an entire day discussing. So we are going to explore this choral finale shortly, but before we do, let's just hear from some people who have had something to do with the performance that is coming up on the 22nd of December. But before we do, I thought you might like to hear an interview or part of an interview recorded in 1981 with Meyer Fredman, the Australian conductor who has conducted quite a few of Havock O'Brien's symphonies, almost half a dozen, I think. And in Australia, he actually was recording for the ABC for a broadcast, a purpose, one of the English suites of Havock O'Brien, these marvellous English suites. He wrote five of them, and they're well worth exploring. So let's go now to Meyer Fredman in 1981, talking about Havock O'Brien.
Havock O'Brien, an extraordinary English composer who was born in the middle 1880s, in his early years. He was a self-taught composer. He was born in Stoke-on-Trent and entirely self-taught as a composer. And I asked him, in his ripe old age, where he learnt composition. And he said he used to walk to Manchester, which was about 50 to 60 miles, to listen to Hans Richter, the great German conductor, conduct the Halle Orchestra, and he learnt all his music that way. He was very instrumental in helping other composers like Elgar and Arnold Bax and people of that generation of English composers, but didn't promulgate his own music, and he was considered quite a revolutionary and rather ignored by the establishment, and lived for all his life without much success, earned his living as best he could by copying music, working in the post office, etc., writing through the night, the night hours. He used to say his the night hours were the best for work. So his whole life was spent with hardly any sleep and writing, I think, about 40 symphonies in the end, a violin concerto, four enormous operas, and a concerto for orchestra. But Beecham was to have given the first performance of The Tigers, an enormous opera, but the 1914 war broke out. Fritz Busch was to have done one in Dresden, a sequel to Richard Strauss's Salome. This was an Elektra, or rather a sequel to Elektra, and this was another Greek subject, one actor to go with Elektra, and the Bush left Germany, and so that never came about. Scores got lost in railway compartments and all sorts of crazy things like that. I met him a number of times. His wife thought I was called Marty Feldman when I mistook my name. And I chatted with him quite a few times, and I grew to know his family very well. His son, who's now in fact reaching 65 in retirement age, I communicate with quite a lot by letter. But his son told me an incredible story that at the day of his father's funeral, which was only, as I say, about 6 or 7 years ago, there was a knock on the front door and a man appeared who was the splitting image of Pat Bryan himself. And he said, "I am, in fact, Havergal Bryan's son." And Pat Bryan said, "Well, that's ridiculous. I'm his son." And he said, "Well, there you are." And it gradually turned out that, in fact, much earlier in the century, Havergal Bryan had had a complete family, wife and about 6 children, and nobody knew anything about it until the day of his funeral, when the second family all discovered this. It's quite a horrifying situation, but a very amusing one, I suppose, to the bystander. And I think there is, in fact, a bit of a lawsuit going on now about it all, as to who is the legal and right and proper family. That's all part of this extraordinary character, this man. He just wrote because he had to, with no hope of performance and so forth. He first began to get noticed only in about the middle 50s, when Dr. Robert Simpson, who is himself a very fine composer and a BBC music producer, was reading through his submitted scores to the BBC, and he came across symphony number, may have been 12 or something like that, and he thought, this is an extraordinary musical mind, and decided to mount a piece called the Gothic Symphony, which was outdid Mahler's Symphony of 1,000, and Sir Adrian Boult put on this performance in the Albert Hall, and the place was absolutely crammed full with performers. Since then, more and more have been come to light, and in fact the BBC, or Robert Simpson rather, has had the go-ahead from the BBC to record all the Havergal Bryan symphonies. I myself, I think, have done 6 of them, two of them for commercial recording. An extraordinary figure. His music of the later period, that is, all these symphonies, which he wrote in his 70s and 80s, I mean, he outdid Verdi, in fact, with Falstaff. Verdi wrote Falstaff about 80 or something, and Havergal Bryan outdid him even. The musical style doesn't resemble any other English composer, or anybody really. It's quite itself. It has the weight and complexity, shall we say, of Bruckner, but it's much shorter. The symphonies each last 15 minutes. The early music, of which this English Suite No. 4 is an example, was a much more simpler style to our ears now, but when it first came out, was quite revolutionary to the English idiom, and that's why he was rather ignored by the so-called establishment at the time. And although Elgar was very pleased with Havergal Bryan's interest in his music and promulgating of it, they fell foul of each other after a while, because I believe Sir Thomas Beecham conducted the Elgar First Symphony with cuts, and Havergal Bryan was furious that this work should be tampered with, but Elgar himself was so pleased to get a performance he didn't care whether there were cuts or not, and so they fell foul of each other. And things like the Vaughan Williams C Symphony vocal score was actually composed by Havergal Bryan, or arranged by Havergal Bryan. Quite an extraordinary character. When I met him, he lived in a little unit down on the Brighton seafront in Sussex. It looked remarkably like Bruckner, actually. The head and the nose was just like Bruckner. And he, very happy, no chip on his shoulder about never getting any performances. And the score of The Tigers, this enormous opera, which never got performed, got lost. The vocal material existed, but the full score got lost. And in his late 60s, about 40 years after the event, he decided to start rewriting the full orchestral score, but failing eyesight prevented this. And after his death, somebody thought of the idea of getting in touch with Miss Rosemary Brown, who was a medium in Islington, who was in touch with the other side, and so they contacted Rosemary Brown, who spoke to Franz Liszt, who spoke to Havergal Bryan, who said that in a disused room on the third floor of Broadcasting House in London they would find the score. But they didn't, actually. They found the room, but no score. Quite an amusing character. There is a book. In fact, that's the book that first got me interested in, by a man called Nettle, called Music in the Five Towns, which are the Potteries area, the Arnold Bennett country of England. And this extraordinary character writing away 1900 to 1955 without hope of performance. This English suite that we are doing in fact, is in the studios, will be the first professional performance of the work.
Conductor Meyer Fredman talking there about his recollections of the composer Havergal Brian. And just before Meyer Fredman recorded one of the English suites of Havergal Brian here in Australia. And now to Brisbane.
In spite of that, he didn't get any exposure to speak of, did he, really? In fact, he himself didn't really expect ever to be performed.
No.
So I suppose, if you don't, you don't think in practical terms of, will the LSO take this up, and are there choirs, can they handle it and get me performances? I don't think it crossed his mind.
Conductor John Currow talking about Havergal Brian's Gothic Symphony and the challenges that he faces as a conductor and indeed the performers face in performing this work on the 22nd of December in the Concert Hall at QPAC right here in Brisbane. This will be the first performance in 30 years in public of this enormous symphony, and indeed it will be only the fifth public performance ever. It's the first public performance outside of England of this mighty symphony. So we're coming now to the great choral finale. The three instrumental movements are quite magnificent, but the crown is the great and unique final setting of the Te Deum. The music of this symphony, particularly the choral and orchestral music, has been referred to by Harold Truscott in his chapter on Havergal Brian in the book The Symphony Elgar to the Present Day. He says, "The combination of voices and orchestra in this symphony is certainly like nothing else in music and must be accounted a supreme feat of realised imagination." So let's now venture in to part two, the choral finale of Havergal Brian's Gothic Symphony. Here Brian employs the full forces in the most disparate kinds of music, and the text itself becomes a unifying force, relating the various musics to this central stream of thought. The first movement of the finale, in other words, the fourth movement of the symphony's overall scheme, is concerned with praise and statement of the acts and nature of God. There's a radiant opening, and it introduces first the choruses and then the vocal soloists. After a big orchestral fanfare, the full forces are unleashed in a fantastic, bell-like, multitudinous sound of rejoicing. Then the usual kinds of thematic development are abandoned, and the music evolves through a series of contrasting episodes which manage, nevertheless, to impose a formal logic on the treatment of the text. So let's start our exploration of the choral finale of Havergal Brian's Gothic Symphony. We take it up with just the last bars of the third movement, the orchestral movement, then leading in to the choral forces. You can hear the complexity of the choral writing that John Currow was referring to, amply displayed there in that opening section of the finale of the Gothic Symphony. Now follows a bold, march-like passage accompanied by timpani, which introduces in a quiet setting of the part of the text of the Te Deum for unaccompanied choirs. March music takes over again and rises to a brief climax, and then magical distant trumpet calls accelerate into a fierce fanfare, bringing a jubilant setting of Tu Rex Gloriae Christi. And we will stay with this section of the Gothic for several sections. There's a part that is interspersed by a tense chromatic canon on some of the text that swells to quite a huge climax. So let's stay now with the opening section of Havergal O'Brien's Gothic Symphony. That was the conclusion of the fourth movement of the Gothic Symphony, and that's the first choral movement. We now come to the fifth movement, and it sets just one line of text. And that text translated says, "We believe that thou shalt come to be our judge." It opens with a very bold stroke, the four choirs singing in overlapping triads, creating dense, glowing chord clusters, and then the solo soprano sings the complete text, and then the choirs launch into a polyphonic passage of fantastic complexity and fierce dissonance. It's divided into over 20 parts. A wordless vocalese for the solo soprano then introduces a thrilling fanfare for trumpets, and then the orchestra enters for the first time in the movement with a grim juggernaut of a march. We come now to the sixth and final movement, and it's the longest of all, and the one that contains the greatest contrasts of material, expression, and scoring. The text is largely concerned with statements of praise and prayers for the future. And that's already been covered quite darkly in the previous movements, but it's expanded upon in this sixth and final movement. We're going to join this movement with the section which is a jaunty marching song. It's heard on nine clarinets supported by percussion. It will be followed by some wordless vocalising. First from the basses and tenors seated, and then the altos, and then all the choirs. This introduces a joyously tuneful setting which builds to a roof-raising climax of forthright, strongly rhythmic splendour. We're near the end of this extraordinary movement now, where literally, with the full brass of the orchestra and bands, with six tympanists and much percussion, they unleash two diabolically dissonant assaults upon the ear. Literally, all hell breaks loose. We come now to the very final section. The final choral murmur is heard serene and unaffected, a far-off mysterious radiance that abides as a light in the night. You've been listening to edited highlights of Havergal O'Brien's Gothic Symphony, his Symphony No. 1, which will be performed for the first time in public outside of England on the 22nd of December this year in the Concert Hall QPAC, conducted by John Currow. The performance is completely sold out, but the open rehearsal at 10 a.m. on the same day, the 22nd of December, is now selling tickets, so you can attend the open rehearsal, and bookings for those to get your ticket is 136246. Tickets for the open rehearsal are $30. The text for the explanation of the music was by Malcolm MacDonald, and Malcolm MacDonald is an eminent Brian authority and scholar, and he will be co-presenting the pre-concert talk for the performance at 8 p.m. on the 22nd of December. My name's Gary Thorpe, the executive producer of the Gothic Symphony Performance and the general manager of 4MBS Classic FM, and I hope you enjoyed tonight's programme.